I'm joining the show, Scott Waters, lead singer for Ultimatum, and also he runs NoLifeTillMetal.com. He also has a really awesome YouTube channel that you guys can check out, and I believe it just goes under your name. Is that correct, Scott?
Yeah, either Scott Waters or No Life Till Metal. Either one will get you there.
Yeah, and of course, I'd love to talk about that here in a minute because you do have, and I'm looking at it, people can't see it right now, but they could see it when they watch the YouTube stuff, is the vast collection of music and music-related items that you have. And I do want to bring that up because there is a little bit of a story about that where you had that collection going and then you, your awesome church that you were attending kind of made you feel convicted. We'll get into that too in a minute if that's cool. But Scott, I appreciate you joining the show, man. I've been wanting to have you on for quite a while.
Not a problem.
Obviously, you seem like you're a little bit passionate about music, just a bit. And
I call it my passion for sure.
Yeah, a super passion, it looks like, and that's cool. And I'm kind of curious, you know, when did that develop for music? But also, you do graphic art, you do art, you do a lot of album work, a cover work, artwork, whatever it might be. But when did those passions kind of come into your life?
Very early, grade school. I was into, like, when I was a kid, I was into the Boy Scouts, and I was really into sports when I was real young. I grew up in New Jersey, so I was a big fan of all the Philadelphia teams because that's where we were closest to. You know, at the time it was the 70s, so the 76ers were a big deal back then, and so were the Phillies with Pete Rose and all those guys being in part of it. But then somewhere in grade school, I discovered, through a teenager who lived down the road from me, I discovered Kiss and Aerosmith and Ted Nugent, and those three bands basically what got me into music. Is once I discovered that, the sports went out the door. Didn't care about it whatsoever. I stuck with the Boy Scouts for a while longer, but again, that kind of went out the door because it was all about music. And drawing was just something I always did. I mean, I was, even with my friends, I'd be like, let's go hang out at my house and go draw. And they're like, draw? But yeah. And then nobody cared.
So you draw by yourself.
It was just something I was always into. My dad was an architect and he was very creative. And
okay.
So it was just something I always liked to do. I could just sit there and draw pictures, and that was fun for me. But yeah, grade school, I literally, in, you know, like fourth and fifth grade, I got into, you know, Aerosmith and Ted Nugent, and Double Live Gonzo was a big one for me right around 76 to 77. All those huge albums that came out around that time. Then not long after that, it became, you know, Motorhead and UFO and Judas Priest and Black Sabbath and all the other bands that surrounded that area. And I just kept delving deeper and deeper into it.
When did, I was going to ask you, what was the first concert that you chose to go to? What was that?
First concert. Now, as much as my parents didn't mind me listening to the music and they never said anything and they'd buy me records for, you know, holidays and, I even, you know, mowed lawns in my area to buy records. That's what I used all my money to do, was buy records. So I never had a problem with it, but they would not take me to a concert. They had no interest in it. I mean, I begged them to take me to see Kiss around in 78. Nope, no interest. Just not their thing, which, that's, you know, it's fine. So I didn't get to start going to concerts until I could drive. But my first concert was in Philadelphia. I went to see Aerosmith and Pat Travers at the Spectrum in 1983. Okay. Which was just before I could drive, but my friends were starting to drive at that point, and my parents were cool with me doing that. So I did that, had the typical 80s concert experience. And unfortunately, you know, the drugs flowed freely at concerts back then.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I partook. I never really got deep into drugs, but I, at that show, it was just like part of the show, you know, it was part of what you did. Right. So, but I did learn in that first show, I learned something. They were throwing out drumsticks out to the audience, and I was close enough where a drumstick landed right in front of me somewhere. But I was so high, I just, like, there's a drumstick.
Yeah, what do I do?
It didn't even grab it. So I was like, yeah, I ain't doing that anymore. Because I want to enjoy the show and not, you know, be stupid. So anyhow, but that was my first show, and I'll never forget it. Aerosmith and Pat Travers, and I'm still a big fan of both bands ever since.
What band have you seen the most?
I've seen Aerosmith probably 12 times. I've seen Ted Nugent 10, 12 times. I've seen a lot of bands, a lot because of being in a band too. So I can name like a lot of underground bands we played with a lot. But actually just buying tickets to go to a concert. Yeah. Aerosmith and Ted Nugent are two that I've seen many, many, many times. At least 12 times each.
Wow.
Kiss, I've seen probably 10 times over the years. So
what was your probably favorite moment seeing Kiss live? I mean, they've had different members. Some members, they got the original. I mean, the original is the original and you want to see those guys, but you know, also better musicians are kind of in there too with the other guys. So I'm kind of curious what.
I mean, I liked all of them, but I mean, my first time seeing them again, I was 83 was when I started going to concerts. Okay. So I went to go see them on the Animalized tour with one of my best friends from high school. And it was at the Spectrum. We were right up front. It was general admission on the floor. So mm-hmm. we were right up front. And the barrier, you know, it had those metal barriers in the front to keep it broke because the crowd was pushing. So it's basically, you know, like two or three steps. So we were on the edge of the stage. So I got to watch the Animalized show from the edge of the stage. They tried for like an hour to get to push the crowd back and tell everybody needs to move back so people can get off the stage. There's fireworks, you know, fire up here. We can't have people on the stage. But nobody would move back. So it was either cancel the show or go on. And so we watched the whole show on the edge of the stage, and there was no fire. They didn't. You could see the grates that down there, all the stuff, but they didn't use it all because we were on stage. So that I'll never, ever forget that show. And then I ended up getting my picture in Faces magazine. Remember that old magazine from the 80s?
I don't know if you remember that one.
Yeah, it was a pretty popular magazine in the 80s. But anyhow, there was a picture of us. Picture of Kiss, obviously. They didn't care about us. But because we were outside the stage, you could see us and my buddy was there. And so I'll never forget that show. But Kiss has never let me down every time I've seen them. So and I've seen all different incarnations. I saw them without makeup probably four or five times. Saw the original guys in makeup, you know, during the reunion tour. And then the following tour for the album that they put out, and then the so-called farewell tour. Saw him twice on that tour when my son was old enough to like him at that point. So me and my son went to see him a couple times, and they were always great. They never put on a bad show.
I've unfortunately never got to see him live. I've seen last year I went to Nashville. They had the Kiss convention. I'm going blank on what the name of it was, but they had Vinny, Ace, and Bruce all play at the same time.
Was it an official Kiss thing? It's KissCon.
No, it wasn't official. It was, because Peter Criss was there too. Yeah, I'm totally going blank on the name of it. Chris Jericho was there performing and stuff. It was really cool though, because apparently, you know, those three guys have never performed together. And seeing Vinnie Vincent was quite interesting. That was not what I expected when I went. I was like, I want to see Vinnie. And I was looking forward to that because I've always enjoyed the Vinnie Vincent Invasion albums, even though
his
solos are going to blow your eardrums out the way he mixed it. But, from that and seeing what I saw, it was different. and then Ace was messing up some, too, because it was just a crazy experience because they had a drum machine playing the drum parts and live bassist play. Yeah, it was not the greatest thing ever, but I wish I could experience seeing Kiss. I don't know, you know, I just never went and saw them, unfortunately, and I regret that because this might actually be their farewell tour for real this time.
Yeah, I mean, they're getting up there in age and mm-hmm. to the point now where they're having to use backing tracks to keep, you know.
Yeah, I've been hearing about that. Yep.
And I get that. These dudes are in their 70s. What do you expect? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, my mom is up there in that age, and I can't picture my mom up there on stage, you know, rocking out like Gene Simmons is.
I know. So I think about that too. Yeah, because my dad, he's like 73, and I would think there is no way. My dad could barely probably walk to the microphone. These guys are doing what they're doing.
Right.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. So, but yeah, I mean, I've seen them. They've never put on it. I never was disappointed by a Kiss show. They always put on a great show. And I've seen a couple of follies, you know, during the Kiss shows that the last time I saw them, Paul Stanley gets up with that thing and he goes out into the audience in the middle of that thing. And he got up there and went out. He sang the two songs or three songs, whatever it was he sang from there. And then he got back up there and he went up and it got stuck.
Oh my gosh.
He was just hanging over the crowd, stuck. And they finally came up and they brought a ladder and they got him down and he ran out. And the whole time the band's still playing Love Gun, I think is what they're playing, or
yeah,
like that. And then he ran out with the security and they finally gets up on stage. But it was just funny. But yeah. I didn't care. It was funny.
It makes that experience more unique for you than being there. So. Were you into comic books at all, or was that the kind of art you were into, or was it different arts, or like were you looking at album artwork at an early age also and mimicking that?
I was looking at album artwork at a very early, when I was in high school, when I took all my art classes, I was always wanting to create band logos and album covers. And of course, when I was in high school, there was a lot of bands, and you know, so I started doing that at a very, very young age. Funny story. I used to paint the back of the denim vests for people. It was very popular in the 80s to get album covers. So I painted a bunch of Iron Maiden ones because they were huge back in when I was in high school. And then I did Merciful Fate. I remember doing I did Queensryche on my own jacket. But what's funny about it is that old Queensryche jacket of mine, I lost track of it years ago. I just figured it was at my parents' house and got thrown away eventually, right? Mm-hmm. Well, my college roommate calls me up, and this is just like maybe a month ago. He's like, dude, you're never gonna guess what I found at my mom's house. And I was like, I've never been to his mom's house, so somehow it must have got mixed up in his crap. And he took it to his mom's, and she was going through stuff, and she's like, do you want this? And he's like, that's not even mine. So I got it back like cool. 2 weeks ago. But anyhow, yeah, I was always into painting album covers and painting, you know, and creating logos and that kind of thing.
Who's your favorite logo that from, I mean, I guess any time period, but maybe best, from back then. Yeah, just the best logo you thought, just, man, this is...
Angel had the best logo ever.
Oh, really? Okay.
Have you ever seen Angel's logo?
I have. I can't remember exactly what it looks like.
It's literally, it's got wings on both sides of it, and it literally, you can flip it over, and it still says Angel, no matter how you flip
okay.
it.
Okay. See, I didn't it's realize the that.
Most creative logos ever, yeah.
I didn't know if maybe you'd say Queen, the old Queen logo, where they had, like, the bird or where all the stuff coming out of it. I always thought that one was pretty cool. And even as generic in a way that the Kiss logo is, just with the S's being the way there are, it's such an iconic logo too.
Yeah. And that's what a logo should be. And that's what people don't understand is, I mean, I'm staring at the Kiss logo right behind you on the wall, but I mean, a logo is supposed to be something simple. It doesn't have to be complicated. I mean, think about it. Look at the McDonald's logo. It's just an M, you know, that's all it is. But you see the M and you immediately think hamburgers, right? Mm-hmm. Or you see that little VW for the Volkswagen. You see that little simple little logo and you think Volkswagen. You know immediately what it is. That's what a logo should be. And that's why that Kiss logo is so perfect. It's simple. It's recognizable. And you know exactly what it is when you see it. Which is why I hate a lot of the modern logos that look like a pile of sticks from a lot of these black metal bands and death metal bands.
I don't get it.
It's not a logo. It's unreadable. It's not even distinguishable from another logo. So nobody looks at it and goes, oh, that's this band. And like they're staring at it like,
you don't even have a way to Google it. You're like, how do I Google this? I don't even know how to decipher. Yeah, I don't understand that whole philosophy either. But I was going to ask you, with the Ultimatum logo, I have to figure you created that, correct?
I did, but it wasn't just me. It was because I joined Ultimatum. Ultimatum was around for maybe 6 months before I joined. Mm-hmm. It was Robert Gutierrez and Steven Trujillo were the two guitar players, and they had been playing together formerly in a band called Angelic Force. So when they formed Ultimatum, Robert was originally singing. He didn't want to sing, but they didn't have a vocalist. And he was trying to convince me the entire time, you should come sing for my band. You should come sing for my band. And I'm like, man, I'm an artist. I'm not a singer.
Yeah.
He's like, you can do it, man. Come sing for my band. Just come try it out. So I'm like, all right. So I go.
Had you been singing at all before that?
No.
I mean, that's a big leap of faith for him to take to, mm-hmm. to say, come on.
He's like, come to a practice and just try out and see what you think. Okay. So I went to practice and I was so, I don't know if the word's embarrassed or shy, or I just I'd never done it before. So I had no confidence in myself. It was a train wreck. It was awful. So I told Robert, like, you know what? Let me go get some singing lessons, take a few singing lessons, and then I'll come back and try it again. And he's like, okay, cool, man. He wanted me in his band for some reason. So I, did. I took some singing lessons, learned how to use my diaphragm and sing like that, and came back. And I'm not saying I was good, but it was better.
How old were you at that time?
In my early 20s.
Were you living out west at that point?
Yes, I moved out into New Mexico I graduated college in 1989, got married in 1989, moved from the East Coast to New Mexico that same year, on that same year.
What took you out to New Mexico? Because that's, you know, a lot of people at that time are going to L.A., but...
My wife's from here, and okay. I went to school for graphic design, and I wanted to get into design and that sort of thing. And everybody in the school is going to New York City or LA, or a lot of people were going to Tennessee because it was a big area too. And I was like, you know what? I want to go somewhere different, somewhere smaller. So my wife was from here. So we came out and visited her parents one time, and I just loved the area. It was so different from what I was used to. It's just so open here, and people are so much more laid back. And even the jobs here, when I got my first job as a graphic designer, it wasn't like beat you over the head, hurry, 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 get it done. It was so much more relaxed, and that's what I liked about it. So when we came out here, I'm like, yep, let's move to New Mexico. I like it there. So
did you grow up in a household with Christianity or faith, or did that come along later?
No, my parents took us as long as I can remember, my parents always took me and my brothers to church, to youth group, to summer, you know, whatever they go. What was it? Summer Bible school.
Yeah, vacation Bible school.
There you go. Vacation Bible school. Always, because they were involved in the Baptist church, and we went to everything. But like I said, my parents never had a problem with me listening to the style to the music I liked.
Yeah.
The church had a problem with it.
I want to ask you about that, because you have had a vast collection up until that point. How big of a collection would you say you had at the point that you eventually got rid of it?
When I moved from out east to here, I had a pickup truck, and we took my pickup truck, and I filled it with records. That's the only thing, with a cap on it and everything. Mm-hmm. So my records took up the entire truck. Anything else we took from there fit in my wife's little four-cylinder, you know, car. So I had a lot.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that church and everything. But when I decided to sell off all my records and get on, and only listen to Christian music for a short time period, excuse me, I sold all those records to a record store here in Waves. They said there was too many for them to buy at one time. But it was enough money to take and put a down deposit on our first home. First home. Several thousand dollars worth of records I sold.
Well, I'm glad you didn't just throw them away.
Well, that's what they wanted me to do. They wanted me to throw them away or burn them. And I'm like, and we can get into this if you want to, but the church I was in was very controlling and very,
Well, how'd you originally get set up in that church? And did you not see things that way at first, or when did that come along this doesn't feel right?
So I was raised in, like I said, I was raised in the church but when I went to college, even though I was raised in the church, I never really was, I'm assuming you're a Christian, right?
Yes.
Okay. So even though I was raised in a church, I didn't really give my life to Christ.
Yeah.
Until I was in college. I guess I just thought of myself as I'm a Christian because I go to church kind of thing. But when I was in college, I met a band called Holy Saint and hung out with them quite a bit, designed their logo. And they were from Rochester, New York, where I was going to school. And it was through not them talking to me, but through what I was seeing in their lives that made me realize, wait a minute, there's a difference between me and them. And that's when I just decided, you know, the Holy Spirit worked in me, and I decided to become a Christian. And I did. I, you know, dedicated my life to Christ at that point. And again, I held on to the music for a while. But even back then, it was a struggle because the church was always like, no, 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 no. You can't do that. You know, you can't listen to Metallica and be a Christian. You know, you can't listen to Megadeth and be a Christian. So it was always a big struggle. But when I got into this other church, when I came here to New Mexico, it was a Word of Faith church, which I didn't even know what Word of Faith was at the time.
Yeah.
And it was very involved with guys like Kenneth Copeland and Kenneth Hagin.
I went to a church probably exactly around the same time as a kid, around 90, 91, Word of Faith.
Yep. And they did a lot of good things. I'm nothing against them. I mean, they do a lot of great things because it was in Albuquerque. So they did a lot of good things for the Albuquerque neighborhood. They were constantly raising money for the schools and doing all kinds of great projects. They were preaching Christ. However, it was very controlling. And the deeper I got into it, it became to the point where my wife and I were literally at church. We'd work all day, get home from work, scarf some food down, or buy junk food on our way to church because we were there every single night. And it got to the point where they were like, "What do you mean you're not coming on Super Bowl Sunday? You'd rather watch the Super Bowl than be here with your church family, and so football's more important to you than God?" And I was like, "And I'm not even a football fan." And I was like, that's when I started seeing it. I'm like, "What?"
Did they have that thing? Because the church we went to, there's like name it, claim it kind of thing.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm.
They were big about that kind of stuff. Name it, claim it, proclaim it, whatever, you know. And
first I went to was called Victory Love Fellowship. It's changed and no longer that. But they also had a college, and I graduated from their Bible college.
Okay.
But it was due to that Bible college that I really got my eyes opened. But what clinched it for me was joining Ultimatum. I joined Ultimatum in 1992, and I was excited about it. Here I am, a Christian in a new Christian band, and I'm writing all the lyrics, so I'm right now in Bible school, so these are going to be Bible based lyrics. I'm gonna slam the Word of God in everybody's face, whether they like it or not. Kind of, you know, that's the way I was. I was a very pious Christian at that point, but when I went to the church and told them that I had joined Ultimatum, they were like, "You can't, you're not allowed."
Really?
What? That you can't join it. You can't join a Christian metal band. What do you mean I can't join a Christian metal band? You're not. They literally said I was not allowed, and that if I did, that all the ministries that I was involved in within the church, I would be cut off from. And then we were very involved. We were teaching a Bible study at a nursing home, which I could tell you really cool stories about. We had a home fellowship, we called them, just basically a home Bible study group that. They had the church had them spread out all over the city, and you know, they had leaders, and then people come to the house, and everybody was teaching the same thing, but it was small Bible studies. So we had that going on. My wife and I also were in charge of the nursery ministries, so we were really deeply involved. But once I did that, suddenly everything changed, and we were like looked down upon. And then within a few weeks, the pastor of this church, it was a big church, gave a sermon, and I still have the cassette tape of it. There is no such thing as Christian metal. It's all incantations.
So he probably came up with this whole message just based on you and your situation.
The funny thing was, is they were fine with Christian rap. They would have these group youth groups where they would have like the half pipes and all that kind of stuff for the skateboarding. Excuse me. Sorry. Bronchitis still there a little bit. And they'd have rap groups come in, and then they'd have rock groups come in. They would have, you know, Daniel Band played there, and, you know, groups like that played there, and they didn't have a problem with that. But when it came to metal, that's evil, and it's all incantations. And he preached a sermon that day, and I could hear clear as day. I'll never tell you that I've heard God speak to me clear, but there's a few times in my life where I can say I clearly heard God tell me something, and I clearly heard God tell me on that day that it was time to move on. Mm-hmm. And that he had another place for me to be. And the thing that confirmed it for me was my wife, not even talking to her, got the same message at the same time, sitting in a chair that day. So after the sermon was over, I'm like really bugged, because he got up there and he talked about, it was 1990, 91 or so. He talked about, 1992 had to be, he talked about Tourniquet and Deliverance and all these different bands. And he was talking about Tourniquet, Stop the Bleeding. They want to stop the blood of Christ, and one bad pig, swine flu, they're glorifying disease. And I'm like, you got this all wrong, man. This is wrong. Deliverance, Weapons of Our Warfare, clearly an album glorifying, you know, violence and war. And I'm like, what?
I'm surprised he even knew the band's names and went into that great of detail. Yeah, that tells me he did.
But he did the research on the surface because he didn't really know what they were really about.
Yeah.
So after the fact, my wife and I went up to the pastor. Again, we were very involved in the church, so we were close with the pastors and everything. And I was like, you're talking about a lot of bands that, and the stuff you were saying was not true. And as we're sitting there talking to him and just having a normal conversation about what was going on, the church starts circling around my wife and I, and Jeez. They're praying in tongues. And I could hear one of the people, just keep praying for him, pray in tongues. They'll give in. They'll understand. I was like, okay,
no,
we're done.
Yeah.
We're out. We're done. So I did the right thing. I didn't just leave the church that day and never come back. I made an appointment with the pastor, said, look, we're moving on. Ultimatum was part of a small Spanish church down in the South Valley. Very small church, like 30 people. Wow. So I let him know we were moving on. We're going to that church. We were going to take part, and we were going to do their nursery ministries. And, you know, the pastor looked at us, my wife and I, and said, no, you're not. That's not what God told me he has for you. I was like, well, we're giving a couple weeks notice because we don't want to just end everything that we're a part of. We want you to be able to find other people to take over. But that's what we did. We stayed for the 2 weeks. They kept saying, no, you're not leaving. And we did our 2 weeks and we left.
Did you ever connect with those people, any of those people later in life?
I still have friends from the church to this day.
Yeah.
One of my friends who was there and very involved like I was back then and went to the Bible college and everything. He still goes to that church. It's like I said, it's no longer that name, and it's a different pastor. It's no longer Word of Faith, but yeah, he still goes there. I'm still really good friends with him. So anyhow, it was weird.
It's funny because I mean I can relate to what you're saying because the church I went to was just very weird and strict with things like that too. And I remember my parents questioning some stuff that the pastor had said and mentioned it to the assistant pastor, and then what do you know, a couple messages later the pastor was basically talking about my parents and another group that had kind of questioned what he said and made it part of the message, almost similar to what you're talking about. It and he was big Kenneth Copeland kind of guy too. Copeland, I believe, that's, is it Copeland or Hagen, but
both of them, they're both, yeah, really big in the 90s.
I mean, and just you know, I can definitely relate in a way to you, but you know, I am curious to kind of off of that. You're talking about listening to Christian music and metal. How did you get introduced to Christian metal or music, and who were you into during those years?
I mean, I knew Christian music early on because, like I said, my parents always took us to church, and to this day, I'm still friends with my youth pastor. He was such an awesome guy from when I was a teenager. I mean, I'd go to youth group wearing, you know, The Who and Aerosmith and Jack Daniels shirts, and the church, and I didn't know any of this until after the fact, but after I graduated college, I graduated Bible school, and I started working for a Christian t-shirt company for several years doing graphic design. I would send my old youth pastor t-shirts of, you know, that I had worked on, just Christian t-shirts. It was Visionwear Christian Clothing. They're no longer in business, but yeah, they were popular in the 90s. Yeah, they were pretty popular in the 90s. But I found out after the fact, like when I was in college, they were sending out little gift packages to all the youth that went off to college, and, you know, just candies and cookies and toothpaste and that kind of thing, which was cool. I mean, I always appreciated it. So I always thought, you know, that always made me appreciate the church. But then after the fact, when he left the church, his very last sermon, apparently I was a big part of his last sermon. The youth pastor became the pastor of the church, and his very last sermon, he wore his typical Baptist, you know, stuff. Mm-hmm. And, but underneath of his shirt, underneath his suit, he wore one of my Christian t-shirts, and he gave a message about condemnation and how you treat people. Well, apparently, even though I didn't know it at the time, the church wanted me out and kept trying to tell the youth pastor to kick me out. That was a bad influence on all the rest of the youth because I was listening to all this music when they wanted me to be listening to Sandy Patty, BJ Thomas. These were the bands everybody was into at the time, you know, or groups, whatever. Amy Grant, that was the stuff everybody was listening to in the 80s that was Christian. So, but my pastor introduced me to Phil Kagi and Petra and Resurrection Band. So he was trying to, like, here's some alternatives you might dig. Instead of listening to Ted Nugent and Aerosmith, here's this. But all it was for me was, okay, now I got Ted Nugent and Aerosmith, and I got Red Band Fest.
Yeah.
So I just last and Phil Keaggy, I'm still a fan of all those bands. So I learned those bands really early on, and I followed the Christian scene, even though I wasn't truly a Christian yet. But anyhow, at the end of his sermon, he took his jacket and his suit off. He goes, "Remember that guy who wanted to kick out of church? And kick out of the church?" He goes, he works for a Christian t-shirt company now and just graduated Bible college. And, and this is one of the shirts he created for me. So I guess he used me as an example, which I always thought was cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
He moved on to be the dean and president of Philadelphia Bible College.
Oh, wow.
So, anyhow, yeah, so it was early, pretty early on. But my first real metal band, I mean, I consider Rez, you know, 70s metal. But, I mean, most people these days wouldn't say so. So I walked into a record store one day and I said, "Hey, what do you got new?" And he goes, and he threw down Stryper's first album. He goes, "Oh, you'll dig these guys." And he had no idea I was, you know, Christian at the time. He's like, you'll love these guys." He goes, "I like everything from Metallica to Monkees." So if he goes, "If you like anything in there, you'll dig this band." So my wife, my wife, who's my girlfriend at the time, and I, we bought the Stryper record, took it home and loved it. So,
and that was Yellow and Black Attack.
It was actually Soldier Under Command had just come out. So yeah, it was their first full length album, I guess I should have said.
Okay.
So yeah, that was, they were the beginning of it for me. And that would have been what, 84?
Yeah.
That album came out. Yeah.
Yeah. Soldiers came out around 85. Yeah. So
it was a brand, it just come out. So I still have it, you know, it was white vinyl when it came out. So
that's cool.
It's one of the few I didn't purge away.
what do you remember what the first kind of concert metal or Christian rock metal that you went and saw that, kind of stood out to you?
I saw a bunch of them because they had concerts all the time. I used to go to Six Flags Great Adventure in Jackson, New Jersey, and they had concerts all the time there. And I was a season pass holder, so I'd get just about any concert that went through there. I'd go to see. So I got to see Keith Green before he passed away. I got to see Petra during the early years. On top of the non-Christian stuff, I saw like Ted Nugent, Molly Hatch, and Alcatraz there. Yeah. So I saw a lot of those concerts there at, in Jackson, New Jersey.
Keith Green, that would have, I would love to have seen him. I had Glenn Kaiser on the podcast and we talked, because he had the friendship with Keith, and that, I was like, "Tell me everything you can about Keith, because I'm so fascinated by his life." So that's really cool. You got, I had the same thing. I grew up around Atlanta, and Six Flags, they had Atlanta Fest every summer, so they would have be like 3 or 4 days of all these Christian artists, big ones and small ones, and playing, and I usually would go see them too. So that was always pretty cool.
We have one of those here too. Ultimatum played one of those. We have an amusement park in New Mexico called Cliffs. It's not Six Flags, but it's called Cliffs, and they have a big main stage, and they have every year something called Freedom Fest around 4th of July, and it's all Christian bands. And we played there with 1 year with Whiteheart, and I can't remember all the bands were there at that time. I just remember Whiteheart was the one I was looking forward to seeing the most. And Ultimatum played that show. We had a great set. I don't usually preach when I'm on stage with Ultimatum because we mostly played bars. And I'll share a story about that too in a second. But I did it that one because it was a Christian festival and it was expected, and I never minded doing it. So we gave a message, and it was a really good turnout. We had a bunch of people drive all the way from Texas and Arizona to come see us play. And the next year, we go to see if we can get back and play that show again. And the Cliff said, "No, we won't have you back." And we're like, "Why? What happened?" And they're like, "Your music is not family friendly or Christian."
How did they determine that in a year?
Just because it was metal. I mean, I guess again, it was very prominent in the you know, 90s and whatnot, that Christian metal was a bad thing. And I still to this day don't understand how you can be okay with Whiteheart and PID, which was one of the things one's been there, but you're not okay with Ultimatum. It didn't make sense to me.
Right.
But at the same time, it solidified the fact that this is not where we're supposed to be. Mm-hmm. We're not supposed to be playing in front of Christians. We're supposed to be in the clubs. We're supposed to be in the bars. We need to be an example to those and shine God's love to those who don't know him, not the ones who already do. And there's a need for both. I mean, people need to be uplifted. Yeah. Christians need to be uplifted. They, you know, Christians fall and stumble. They need help. So there's nothing wrong with that. But it just wasn't obviously where God wanted us to be. And we quickly moved into the playing the clubs and playing with secular bands, not Christian bands. And it from that point on, it really exploded. And, you know, that's when we got signed to the big secular labels in Germany. And that's when, you know, we were getting all the club shows and playing all over the place. It just worked out much better for us when we moved away from playing to the church.
What was the story you said, or was kind of mentioning or alluding to, with the bar, that you had an incident or?
Early on, we played a bar, and it was our show. We booked it. We needed two other bands to play, so we had the Moshketeers play, and Paul Skazafava is the main guy in the Moshketeers. He is a preacher. He was a Calvary Chapel preacher for years, and a very close friend of mine to this day. I still see him physically at least once a week.
Oh, cool.
So I'm not saying anything bad about them, even though the story is going to make it sound like that a little bit. And then the main band we played middle, and then we had one other band called Dark Truth, who was a non-Christian band, and the singer had fangs, and they were like into like vampire stuff. It was just their kind of
it was their
shtick, you know what I mean? It wasn't like they were actually Satanists or something. It was their on-stage shtick. But those guys had lights and sound systems and all the stuff that we didn't have. So, and they were friends of ours, so we invited them to play. Anyhow, the Moshketeers get on the stage show, they do their thing in a club, people are there, they're drinking, they're doing their thing, eating, whatever it is. And he preaches a message at the club, which didn't bother me. I'm used to it. I mean, I know Christians, didn't think anything of it. Ultimatum got up there, we did our thing, we played our show. I didn't preach a message because we didn't do that at clubs, and we had a different philosophy. We felt we needed to act. I can tell you that too in a minute. But no, anyhow, we didn't do it. And then Dark Truth played, and then after it was all over with and the club was clearing out, I went to the owner of the club, and I'm like, all right, you know, I'm here to collect, because they were going to pay us a certain amount of money. And he's like, he looked at me, and he was pissed. He goes, not only should I not pay you, he goes, I should kick your ass. And I'm like, what did we do? I had no clue. I didn't know what happened. I thought it was a great show. Lots of people here. What's the problem? He goes, I pay you to come in and play music and entertain my patrons. I do not pay you to come in and tell them not to drink my alcohol and not to buy my food because it's sinful. He goes, I didn't pay you to come in here and preach a message to my patrons. He goes, so you are not welcome to play here ever again. And he goes, if I have anything to say about it, you won't play anywhere in Albuquerque. Luckily, that didn't happen. But he did pay us, but we never played that club again, and we're never invited back to ever play again. And it was a valuable lesson, because he was right. We were being paid to do something, and we didn't do that. Hmm. We, you know what I mean? Or we
did,
allowed.
Did you have that? Well, did you have that conversation with those guys?
The Moshketeers?
Yeah.
No, because I didn't think about happened. It. After the fact, yeah.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, I didn't think about it, because it was just, I'd been so used to Christian music and going to Christian shows that it was just part of the show for me. And nope, they didn't have it. And it was a valuable lesson. So we took a totally different approach to playing shows as opposed to preaching a message to the crowd. We would stick around, you know, afterwards and go to our merch booth, and the whole band would go back there and, you know, we'd sign autographs and that kind of silly stuff. But anybody who was, we'd cut. You have tons of people. Hey man, I'm going through this. Can you pray for me? Hey man, I'm going through that. Can you pray for me?
That's when you use when you have the witness part come in, or
that became more important.
Yeah.
But here's the clincher. This is the one that really worked for us. We were not playing with Christian bands. We were playing with secular bands. That was what we want. Those were the bands. So, and any band that was coming through town, like we played with Exciter and Vindicator, and gosh, I'm trying to think of some of the bands we played with. Vector. We played with so many, you know, secular bands when they're coming through town touring. That's one of the things that we decided to do as a band, was any band that's traveling through that we're playing with, we're going to help them load and unload their gear.
Okay.
No questions asked, just, and nobody's allowed to drink.
Yeah, I mean, that's awesome.
I don't care if you have a beer when you're at home with your wife, but when we're in a bar with Ultimatum is the ministry. Nobody's drinking. That's just the way it goes. And we're here to help the other bands as well. So we became friends with a lot of other bands, because like Vindicator, to this day, Vindicator is on my label now.
Oh, cool.
We put out their last album for them. We became friends with them. We went out to their truck and helped them unload their equipment. And they're like, aren't you guys an Ultimatum? Yeah. the singer was a fan of ours. I had no idea. He goes, why are you helping us? I'm like, why not? We're all in bands. We're all going to load equipment. So let's do it. So we did. Loaded and unloaded their equipment like I said, friends with him to this day.
Yeah, that's a good philosophy. Some of
those fans I've actually had call me and you know, hey man, my dad's really sick. Can you, you know, he goes, you know, I don't really believe in God, but I'd appreciate some prayers for my dad. It's like, well, you must have some belief in God if you're calling me asking me for.
Right, exactly.
So that it worked really well, and I just believe that's where God led us to be, as opposed to playing youth groups and preaching messages from the stage.
Yeah.
Lead by example, as opposed to by words.
What were some of the more well-known bands that you got to play with during that time? I know you mentioned some there, but I didn't know if there.
Yeah, I'm trying to think some more of them.
Did you ever play with Death?
No. Never played with Death. Let's see. We played with some Christian bands too. Like we brought Mortification into town. Mm-hmm. We played with Precious Death. We played with Jesus Freaks.
Yeah, I remember all the. I've had
Disciple, Living Sacrifice. We brought them into town, and it's not like we were exclusively playing with secular bands, but mm-hmm. we would do shows and bring other Christian bands into town. But see, Exciter. Who else was there? There's so many bands. It's been so many years. It's hard to remember them all.
Were you mainly just playing that area during that time, or were you going out and doing any kind of touring?
We weren't touring like weeks at a time, but yeah, we were playing. We played in California a lot. We played in Arizona a lot. We played in New Mexico a lot. We kind of hated playing in New Mexico because we were just a local band, and you know what I mean? But then we'd go and play in Arizona. Like I remember we played one time in Arizona and we were playing with a bunch of other non-Christian bands, and we were the headliner because we were the out of town band. It was like 1 o'clock in the morning, 12 o'clock at night. It was 100 and some odd degrees. The club was baking hot, but the place was packed. You know what I mean? And people were loving it, and it was a blast. But in any case, yeah, we played all over the place. We played Colorado, we played Cornerstone several different times, both in Illinois and Cornerstone, California. I don't know if you even know, but I sang for Vengeance for a few years as well.
No.
I didn't know that. 2004, 2002, Ultimatum played a big show in Anaheim. It was a festival with a bunch of Christian bands, and there was a band there called Salt, who you probably don't know because nobody knows them. Yeah. But two of the guys in Salt were from Vengeance Rising. And one of the guys was George Ochoa from Deliverance, the ex-guitar player from Deliverance.
Yeah, I've had George Ochoa.
Yeah, and it was kind of like a 90s style of like Creed kind of music they were playing at the time. And they had Larry Farkas, who was a guitar shredder, on bass.
Oh, yeah.
So funny. So anyhow, during our set, the place was packed. It was a great show. But we were doing Burn. We were covering Burn by Vengeance. And because we were playing...
I love that song.
Me too. Because we were playing mostly secular arenas and we were on a secular label, most people didn't even realize it was a cover. It just, you know, a lot of people didn't know. But when we played the song there, Larry and Glenn Mancuso were in the crowd and heard us play it. Well, after we got off stage, Larry, Glenn, and Robert Sweet all came back behind stage to talk to us. And Larry says to me, dude, if we ever do a Vengeance reunion, you got to come sing for us. I was like, all right, cool. If you ever do a Vengeance reunion, let me know. I'll do it. 2004, I get a call, and they're doing a Vengeance reunion show. Just one show, going to be called Vengeance Rising, and they're going to do most of the songs off the first two albums only, playing in Anaheim, and I'm going to sing for them. Here's the pile of songs, learn them. And I did. And it was recorded for a DVD, which was released on Rox Records at the time.
Is that something that's on YouTube that people can check out by any chance?
I'm sure there is. If you go to look for one,
I'd love to see that.
The day of the show, they changed the name of the band from Vengeance Rising to Once Dead. So it became Once Dead, and the DVD was released as Once Dead Return with a Vengeance.
And I was going to say, Roger probably wasn't supportive of that if anything was heard from him, I'm sure.
He did contact me and during that time. I can't remember the whole story, but he was actually kind of nice. I had met him before. When he was in Vengeance, and I spent a whole afternoon with him one day, and he was like a walking Bible back then. But even when I talked to him before the Once Dead show, he was not like people say he is. You know what I mean? He wasn't like this mean, nasty. You're gonna burn in hell, and I hate you. And you know, he wasn't like that. He was pretty nice. But yeah, they basically changed the name out of respect for him, not necessarily because they were worried about him suing or any of that kind of thing.
How was it to try to?
Everybody thinks he owns the name, but he doesn't own the name.
Okay. Well, I mean, I know some other stuff. I won't get into it. Stuff that, you know, I'll mention when we're done with recording.
I sang for them for 2 years, so I heard all the stories.
Well, I was gonna say, how was it to try to? Did you try to fit that vocal style of Roger?
Yes.
You know, the whole Cookie Monster thing, as people.
Yes, refer to I did.
It as. How did you? Do performing that? How did that feel for you as a singer?
I had a blast. It was, I mean, they were one of my favorite bands, so it was, you know, I loved it. We did the one show, which was all supposed to be in 2004, and the band had such a good time that they were like, hey, you know, let's keep it going and see if we can book some more shows. So we went out and we played in Switzerland at the Elements Rock Festival. We played a bunch of other festivals, and it lasted, like I said, I was in it for about 2 years before I was given what I call the left foot of fellowship out of the band.
Okay. what was the lineup when you were playing with? Did it change, or was it one official lineup?
It changed quite a bit in the 2 years that I was in the band. Okay. It started off as the original guys and me, you know, the original Vengeance Rising and me. And then
was Roger Dell part of that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And him and I were doing bodybuilding and stuff. So we kind of developed a quick bond and stayed friends. But then he was too far away. He was in Tennessee. Yeah. The rest of the band was all in California, and I was in New Mexico, which is still far away. But I mean, it was like a $75, $90 flight out there. So it wasn't like it was real expensive. Excuse me again. Bronchitis. it was a blast.
That's your next ultimatum album. It's going to be called Bronchitis.
Bronchitis, yeah. it was a blast. I loved singing for them. I had a lot of fun. So we did all the shows. We were supposed to record an album. It was a lot of work for me because I was still doing Ultimatum and I was doing Once Dead, and there was nobody in Once Dead who was doing the grunt work of like websites. So I created the website and answering emails and answering letters and all the other kind of stuff you got to do as a band.
Yeah.
So that was becoming my responsibility. Not because they said it's your responsibility, because nobody else was doing it. So I was, but Doug and I started writing songs. I wrote a few songs for them lyric wise. The one that I remember the most was called Body Parts. But then they brought me out to California to record a demo, and Roger Dale was out of the band at this point, and they had brought in ex-Reverend bass player Angelo Spino to play instead. So he had a small studio in his apartment. So we went out there, and they were like, okay, we want you to sing this song. And I'm like, I never even heard this song before. It was a new Vengeance Rising song, a new Once Dead song. Never even heard it. Here's the lyrics. Sing it. I was like, okay. Without practicing it or knowing anything.
Yeah, what's the rhythm?
Right, what's going on? So he kind of tells me what he wants me to do. He's like, but we don't want you to sing it like Roger. We want you to sing it like Bon Scott.
Okay. What?
Okay. So I'm like, because I used to get that comparison back in the early days of Ultimatum all the time on Symphonic Extremity. You sound like Bon Scott. I'm like, okay. So I was very uncomfortable singing it like that. And they're like, now sing it like this. Now sing it like that. Now sing it like this. And they kept like, tell me different ways to sing it. And then at the end, they're like, okay, now sing it how you want to sing it. So I grunted it out in the way I thought worked for the song and in the typical, you know, Ultimatum / Once Dead fashion. And I thought it sounded great. And my bass player from Ultimatum was in the studio with me listening. He goes, dude, that was great. That sounded awesome. 2 weeks later, I was kicked out of the band. and what they told me was one thing. I found out the truth later. They kicked me out originally they told me it was because I was too far away and it was too expensive to have me keep going out there and back and all that kind of stuff. And what I come to find out was Larry Farkas was upset because they were pre-selling the album, the new Once Dead album that I was writing the songs for. And they were getting tons of Ultimatum fans buying the album and mentioning a huge Ultimatum fan and can't wait for this album. That upset him quite a bit that the band was getting compared to Ultimatum. So he basically told the band either he's out or I'm out. So, I was kicked out. I didn't care. I mean,
you still had Ultimatum as your primary thing.
Yeah. So after it was funny because Angelo Spina wasn't even a Christian. And still isn't.
Okay.
Was and so I call each of those guys individually after Doug called me and I called them all up and I'm like, hey man, I was really appreciate the 2 years we got to jam together. It was, and I just had this really friendly conversation thanking him for 2 years of fun, you know, and singing for one of my favorite bands. And I think that was shocking to them, but it was really shocking to Angelo, because Angelo was like really like held back on the phone, like he was waiting for me to like blow a gasket at him. Yeah. I'm like, man, it was so cool meeting you. I'm such a big fan of you, you know, as a fan of Reverend and such a big fan of Vince Dead. I wish you guys all the best. And he was like, really? I'm like, yeah. He goes, I thought you'd be mad and upset. I'm like, why? He goes, well, you got kicked out. I'm like, I don't care. It was fun. We had 2 years of fun, and I get it. You guys need to move on. And you know, my main gig's Ultimatum anyhow. It's not a big deal. So again, I remain friends with him to this day because of it.
Did someone come in and replace you? Did they continue?
Yes.
Didn't they record something?
They did record an album with a new vocalist who was a wonderful guy. He used to sing in a metalcore band with Jim Chafin on drums called I can't remember the name of the band. Life of Me.
Crucified or
no? No, it was after that. It don't matter. Gosh, that's just total old brain fart right there. Anyhow,
that's okay.
He was the metalcore sounding style where it's like, yeah. I call it an angry drill sergeant yelling at a lazy cadet. That's kind of the style of music singing he did. So he came in and he sang the album. They didn't use any of my lyrics, which Doug told me he wasn't. However, they did end up using my song title and my idea for Body Parts. So they had a song on the album called Body Parts, which was my title and my song idea, which I got no credit for, but whatever, I don't care.
I'm sure it still bothers you a little bit. I mean, I know it bothered me just.
Well, what I did was I took the song that I wrote called Body Parts, and and on the last Ultimatum album, Heart of Metal, I recorded a song called Scattered Body Parts.
Okay. And
that's the song that, you know, the same idea of the song, but with my lyrics that I wrote for that song. And we ended up using it for an Ultimatum song. So, it really doesn't bother me all that much. But, you know, when I share the story, people are like, I don't see your name on there. Well, that's because they didn't give me credit for it. That's why. Yeah. And I don't care. It's not my lyrics. It was just my song idea. So really, I don't deserve any credits for it. So, but yeah, it was good. It was a good time. I enjoyed it.
I didn't realize that. Yeah. That's really cool. Have you spoken to Roger anytime recently or kept up with him? I know he just posted a recent video with an interview talking about kind of being a Satanist and his stuff.
I haven't kept up with him at all. I do a lot of artwork for a bunch of different labels, and so I've done Vengeance reissues and stuff like that. It's my own. I just know that he was so, like, nobody could find him for a long time, so he wasn't getting his royalty checks. And the label that was we were working with had money put aside for him. Excuse me. And they eventually found him and paid him. That's my only thing I know about him.
Yeah, I know he's came out lately, and I mean, I'd love to have him on the show if he would come on just to talk with him. And you know, I'm not here to be judgmental of anyone's lifestyle or whether you believe something different than me. I just want to hear the guy's story and you know, his history and what he believes now. I give him a platform. I'd be interested in hearing him. Yeah. But I had no clue about the Vengeance. A couple of years there with you being part of that group. That's really cool. And I would love.
That's the name of the hardcore, metalcore band.
It's been bothering you that whole time.
I knew it would pop up in my brain. Devin was the singer's name, and such a sweet guy and a great singer for that style. I just didn't think he fit in Vengeance style music. So I feel like I'm saying something bad about Devin, and I don't want to do that because Devin's such a great guy. But I don't like the album because of his vocals. And it's not because I think he's a bad vocalist. It's just the style, that metalcore style, doesn't mix with the thrash metal they were doing.
Who published that album? Do you remember?
I can't remember, but that label is defunct, and it was a really poor release.
Yeah.
For many reasons. I mean, I can tell you the reasons why it was so poor and poorly received. First of all, they were recording the album, and Larry Farkas wrote a lot of the music. Glenn Rogers, who was in Deliverance and early Vengeance, was around that camp too and was part of it. But just like Larry had me, you know, either get rid of Scott or I'm out of the band, it was kind of the same deal with the music. As they start recording a new album, it was, you do this, then you can't use my songs. You do that, then I'm out of the band. So it got worse and worse and worse. They finally signed with this label, And he was mad because he didn't want to sign with the label. He felt it should only be available as digital downloads, which most metal fans hate digital downloads. They want physical media. And so he left the band because they signed with that label. Glenn took over, and at the last minute, they had to write a bunch of new songs in the middle of the recording process.
Sounds like a big mess.
It was a big mess. And then they had, it was a mess. It's just a huge mess. But one of the songs on that album was an old Vengeance song that was recorded, that was written for the third album that obviously never happened with the original band. I was so looking forward to singing that song because I heard them play it when they toured Albuquerque in 1991, I believe it was. And they played that song and it never got recorded. And then we're like, yeah, we're going to record that song. I was like, right on. We're looking forward to singing that. But they ended up having him sing it. And he did a good job. It's just, I'm not a big fan of metalcore, so the vocals just kind of ruin it for me.
And I want to talk about Ultimatum. There's plenty we could talk about, but for time's sake, I don't want to. Obviously, there's a couple things I want to hit on and ask you about.
Yeah.
One, mainly being hooking up with Steve Rowe from Mortification and working, doing stuff with Rowe Productions. How did that come about? And your relationship with you? Do you still talk to Steve at all by any chance?
I can tell you. I don't talk to Steve, and it's not anything personal. I'll tell you why. It's because he had a stroke a couple years ago and no longer can. So I do email him on occasion, but his eyesight is so bad. You literally have to make it the biggest font you possibly can for him to read it. And his texts back are usually very scattered because the stroke, there won't be any more music coming from Steve Rowe.
Yeah.
Because the stroke, he had, all the crazy stuff he went through and with the cancer and the.
Yeah. I read his book recently.
Yeah. It's crazy. All the stuff he went through, but yeah. So he can't play bass anymore. And, so I'm still in touch with him, but no, I don't unfortunately get to speak with him anymore. Okay. How we met him 1995, we booked Mortification and Jesus Freaks, to play Albuquerque. Mm. They were on their, Blood World tour. And we booked the venue, booked the show, brought them in. We were the opening band, and Steve Rowe watched our entire show from the side of the stage when we played. And after the show, he came to our merchandise table and he said, "I want to buy all your merchandise."
Mm. Wow.
So after the whatever fans were there bought whatever they wanted, he literally bought everything we had and took it on tour with him for the rest of the tour. And wore our shirts on stage for the rest of the tour. So if you look at some of the albums, he's always wearing an Ultimatum shirt because he bought them all.
Yeah.
And he was selling. Cool. So soon after, after the tour was over, and then he recorded his album here with George Ochoa in L.A., and then he flew back to Australia. I get a call from Steve Rowe one day in his very thick Australian accent. And he's like, "Rowe," he goes, "I want to sign you to do a record." He goes, "I want to sign Ultimatum to do a record. 3-album contract." And we were like, "Oh, that's awesome, but we already signed a contract with another label to put out the next album, which would have been Puppet of Destruction. We signed with Morphine Records, and Morphine was putting out Crimson Thorn at the time and 8-Ball Cholos and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But then they started having money issues, so I went to the label and I'm like, I talked to his name was Burrito. And I said, "Hey, Burrito, we got an offer from Steve Rowe and Rowe Productions to do a 3-album deal with him." And he's like, "No problem, man. I'll let you go for your contract." So that was really cool.
Oh, so that is.
So we recorded our first song for Steve. We sent a demo track out there of a song called World of Sin, which ended up being a bonus track on the first album. He hated it.
Really?
So he put it on the 2000 on some compilation he put out, US metal compilation he put out, but the contract didn't come because he didn't like the song. We didn't know that. He didn't tell us that. He just didn't like the song. And the reason he didn't like it was our drummer, who we had parted ways with in the meantime, was a single bass drummer. And he wanted to hear that pounding double bass. So we recorded a second demo, again, not knowing he didn't like the first track. We recorded the song Never. That was his first track on Public Destruction. And I sent him a cassette tape in the mail. And again, I got a phone call. "Oh my gosh, dude, this is killer. I love this track." He goes, "Why did you send me this one the first time?" And I'm like, "We hadn't written it yet." He goes, "I got to be honest with you, man." He goes, "I loved you guys live and I wanted to sign you." And he goes, but I didn't like that song you guys wrote, World of Sin. And he's like, it's just the drummer, you guys. And I'm like, well, we're going to re-record this song with our current drummer who plays double bass. Perfect. So he signed us for 3-album contract. And we remained friends throughout the years. Several times he tried to take us out on tour with them. But the problem was, is they were the headline band, so they made the money. Our money only would come through selling merchandise at the tables.
Yeah.
And we all were, you know, married, had kids, and I just couldn't take off for 3 months with mortification and, you know, make $25 a night, not even enough to, you know, feed yourself on. So, so we never went on tour with them, but we, every time they came anywhere near here, you know, we played with them.
What was the first album you did on the label with him?
That was when Puppet of Destruction.
Okay.
And it was the last album too.
Oh, really? So you only did one.
And with him, yes. And that, again, for good reasons, not for bad reasons, not because he dumped us or something like that. For the third album, Mechanics of Perilous Times, we recorded a Testament cover for a Testament tribute CD called Jump in the Pit.
Okay.
And we did Sins of Omission, which is a great song, both musically and lyrically. We were really picky and we took it to our pastor, made sure he thought the lyrics were okay, because that's how we wanted, just what we were at the time, you know, how focused we were. And the label in Germany called Massacre Records.
Yeah.
They had a band called Blackened from their label was also on that compilation. So they heard our track and got a hold of us and they're like, we love the stuff you're doing. Do you have more? And it's like, yeah, we have a new album. We just put it out. Literally put out on our own. We were going to put out on our own label and on Row, because Row was mostly in Australia at the time. They hadn't moved to the U.S. yet. And he's like, we want to put it out. So I called Steve and I'm like, hey, Massacre Records is wanting to sign us. He's like, dude, do it. He goes, you're out of your contract. Not a problem. He goes, I've always just been a fan and I wanted you to, you know, be able to step up and do bigger and better things. Go for it. So we ended up recording our third album for Massacre Records. And our last album, every album, it was a different label for us. So,
was Massacre, did Savior Machine work with them too? Was part of their?
Could have been. I don't know.
I want to say, I know I recently was looking at something with Massacre was involved. It might have been, but, and I also was going to ask you about the album artwork. I thought I read, I don't know if this is true. Let you correct it if not, but did you do every piece of art except for one album for the cover art?
I did the layout for all of them, the design work and all that stuff. I did the album covers for all but two. And it was with good reason. I wanted something outside of my spectrum, you know, outside of what I usually do. For Into the Pit, I wanted this demonic creature chained inside the pits of hell, not very comic book ish kind of thing, and I'm not a comic book artist. It wasn't my style, so we hired a guy named Rex to do it. Rexorcist was his nickname, and he did a fantastic job. That was his cover. I did the layout and everything else, but he did the cover. And then on Heart of Metal, the last album we did, again, we wanted something that wasn't my style. We wanted a comic book image of a guy ripping out his own heart and holding it in front of you and being a big metal heart. So we hired a guy to do that. Ended up being me on the cover. That wasn't what we asked for, but that's what he did, which was fine. So it was me ripping out my own heart with my vest on and all the stuff, all the garb I wore on stage. So, two albums I didn't do the front covers on.
Okay. And also talking about doing album covers, what are some of the bigger ones or ones that stand out that you've worked with artists that you've gotten to do? I mean, you've done so many, and I know you've really been busy lately too, which is good for you.
I've been doing this for the last 5 years on my own. I quit my job of 27 years to go into business and do this by myself. So I've been working with Retroactive Records all that time. Literally, I called them the day I went and got my business license. I'm like, hey, Matt Hunt. Hey, Matt, just started my own business. Doing graphic design. If you need anybody, you know, give me a call and let me know. And because we were on his label at one time, he's like, your timing is perfect. He goes, we have nobody. You can do everything.
Oh, wow.
He goes, I got a pile of work for you to do. So that's started immediately.
Yeah.
And then he's friends with Gerder, So Gerder was asking me to do small things here and there. Hey, I need a scan of this. Hey, can you fix this? Can you? And I ended up just, he got so big and busy. He was the owner of the company. He could no longer, he no longer had the time to do all his own graphics. So now I do all the Gerder stuff as well. And I picked up Soundmass, and I've been doing Rocks Record stuff even before I had my own business, because I became friends with Bill Baffert from Rocks many, many moons ago. And I've done probably just about every album they put out.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that with Bill Baffert with Rocks Records, about your relationship, because you guys seem pretty tight.
Yeah, he's, I consider him a brother, really. I mean, honestly, I'm actually closer to him than I, and this is going to sound bad. I'm actually closer to him than I am with my own brothers, my actual brothers. I talk to him all the time, and I do consider him a brother. I fly out to LA every once in a while, and I'll spend the, you know, at least a weekend, sometimes a week with him and his wife, and we'll go out and do things together and check out some bands and, you know, meet with bands that we want to sign, those kind of things. So he's literally my partner in Rocks Records and Electro Metal Records.
And sometimes he'll be on your YouTube channel, and you guys will discuss things too.
Yep. Yeah, I have guests on there occasionally. And yeah, he's, it's 2002, I think it was. He brought us out to, he booked us to play the Striper Expo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was about to ask you.
We played the Striper Expo. That was him and another guy that were involved, not together. And that's really where I, you know, got to know him, you know, meet him. And then every year after that, he'd bring us out to California to play some show. Because he started booking bands a lot, so that's and then we just stayed in touch and became friends. And then he needed artwork, and so I do artwork for him, and we just became friends over the years.
How was that playing the Striper Expo for you? Because really, Striper at that point really weren't doing much at all. I mean, you know, besides the Expo, they did the Expo. What was it, New York or something like that? Then they did
they went on East Coast, and they did Anaheim.
Yeah,
because it was Expo 2. The next year, and it was sold out. There was people everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
We played on they had two stages, one indoor, one outdoor. It was filmed for a video, but Oz and Michael aren't really into the heavier styles of music we're playing.
Yeah.
So we got we were playing the outdoor stage, and they wouldn't even allow our music on the final video. It was just not to their liking, let's just say.
Sure, that's a little bit of a letdown, especially being if you're a Striper fan.
We still got to play the Expo, and it ended up being a big, big turning point in Ultimatum's, I'm not say career, but just in Ultimatum, because it ended up being our last show with our bass player that we had been with for the last decade, and a guy in the audience who had just gotten out of prison for being the drug runner for the Hell's Angels. He was their meth dealer. He was in the audience, and he had become a Christian while he was in jail. He bought a compilation that we were on and decided to come to, he didn't like Striper, but he liked other heavier bands. So he came to the Expo to see Ultimatum play. Just out in the audience, he came up, met us, had us sign his stuff. No idea who the guy was. His name was Rob Whitlock. Ended up the next week, we put an ad out. We need a bass player, because we parted ways with the bass player we had. Mm. And he answered the call. He's like, hey, I'm a bass player. I've played in bands my whole life. And, Christian. And so he moved from California to New Mexico and reigned in Ultimatum till 2012.
Wow, that's crazy. I'm sure he had some crazy stories he probably told you too about his days doing that stuff.
Oh yeah, he basically likens and it's not my, you know, my story to tell, it's his, but he likens it to, you know, Jonah being swallowed by the whale. He had to be swallowed by the whale to get his life right, and and get his relationship with God right. So
how many album covers would you say you've done altogether? Do you even have an idea?
I've done hundreds. I have no idea.
Yeah.
I've been doing album covers since the late 80s. I don't even know. And layouts is even more. I don't always do the front covers. So even if I don't do the front cover, I'm still doing the layouts. So that becomes it's just as much work.
What would be a dream come true band to get to do something with?
Maybe one of my favorites, like I said, I've been Aerosmith and Ted Nugent fan for decades. I mean, I've met Ted Nugent several times, super nice guy. I mean, I'd love to do something with him or Aerosmith or one of those bigger bands, but you know, those guys are all getting old and not really putting out a whole lot of music anymore. So, I'm actually really good friends with Ron Reinhart, another guy I consider my brother from Dark Angel.
Mm-hmm.
And, They're working on new music, which everybody knows. They haven't announced what, when, or where yet. But I mean, I'd love to work with them. I'm hoping that opportunity might happen. So we'll see.
And of course, I got to mention, you know, we talked about you getting rid of your old collection, but you've obviously collected a quite a bit since then. What are some of like the most important pieces of your collection that mean probably the most to you, or any special pieces that you have, or albums, yeah, or anything?
There's a bunch. I mean, a lot of them are because I have a personal connection with the band somehow, or with that album somehow. But like when I was in high school, I created the logo for a band called Heathen's Rage, who have this. It's weird because they only ever officially put out one EP and then a bunch of demos, but they have this cult-like following, especially in Europe and really in Greece. So much so that they were brought out to play like to do a tour out in Europe just a few years ago, 2015. But I designed the original logo, and their guitar player was one of my high school buddies. I'm still friends with him to this day. So owning that original album, which sells for I've not ever seen a copy go under $500 for that one album they put out. But I have two copies, one signed, one not, in my collection. So, you know, that kind of stuff is, even if it was only a $10 record, it's still important to me because it was part of my youth, part of my high school, part of my friends, and I did some artwork for them, you know. So that's, you know, then I have stuff that's just really collectible. Like I've been a huge fan of Anvil since 1983. And I have their very first Anvil album before they changed their name to Anvil, because they were originally called Lips.
So isn't that one album, the guy that's his name he goes by, Lips?
Lips, mm-hmm, the singer.
Okay,
So but it originally came out under the name Lips, Hard and Heavy, and then they got picked up by a label in Canada called Attic, and the name of the band became Anvil, Hard and Heavy. So I have one of the original Lips albums, and that long story, which I don't have time to tell you here, but that was gifted to me by a friend that I stayed in contact with for years. So like I said, a lot of the stuff that I have that's most valuable to me is because I have an emotional connection to it, more so than a money connection, you know.
Or how about even just meeting a personal hero or celebrity or something that sticks out that you had opportunity to do that means a lot to you?
Yeah, I met Ted Nugent three times in my life, and all three times it was unbelievable. And I could tell you a story about each one of them of how kind and generous and awesome the guy was. The first time I met him was just at a book signing. His wife put out a book. He was there. They were at a local thing. My son, my wife, and I all went. Sorry. And I brought records to get signed, and we bought the book, so we're gonna get the book signed. And my son was a fan at the time, and he was a drummer. He brought a drum head to get signed, and we get into the line. We're waiting. My son was long blonde hair at the time. He's now 30 and short hair and very much into business.
So
we get up to Ted Nugent, and the guy right before we get there is like, you can't, he won't sign any of those things. The only thing he'll sign is the book. And they're like, and you had to buy the book here. Did you buy the book here today? We're like, yeah, we bought the book here today. That's the only thing he's going to sign. And Ted Nugent overheard the whole thing. And we get up there, and he's like, don't listen to him. He goes, give me your stuff. I'll sign it for you.
Yeah.
So he signed my album, and he signed my wife had an album and signed her album. And then my son has this little drum head there, and he looks at him. He goes, how old are you? And my son was like 12 or 13 at the time. He's like, I'm 12. He goes, and you're a musician? He goes, yep. He goes, I'll sign your drum head for you. And he goes, and he reaches in his pocket, and he grabs a 10-year-old guitar pick, and he goes, and he puts it out in front of me, and my son goes to grab it from him, and he holds on to it. He goes, I'm going to give you this, but I'm only going to give you this if you promise me you're not going to put poison in your body. No drugs, awesome. No alcohol. And he puts it, and he hands it to him, and gives it to him. And so I just thought that was the coolest thing ever, that he had something to say to a small kid like that, you know, to keep him on the straight and narrow. I thought that was awesome.
I mean, that's kind of like when you were talking about with Ultimatum, using the time at merch to talk to people, to tell them a kind of a message, that he used that opportunity to tell his message to your son. That's really cool.
I mean, I guess let me share one more Ted Nugent story, and then
of course,
before we move on, I know we're probably way over our time because I'm a chatterbox.
No limit here. My kids just keep coming in to bother me, though.
That's all right. I'll keep I have a friend who's no longer living, but that I met online. I used to, at my old website, No Light to Metal. It's still up there, but it's not updated anymore. Okay. I have this huge Ted Nugent section as part of it, which just shows off a bunch of the CDs I have and, you know, that kind of thing. And I got a call from this guy one day. Hey, I love your website. I'm a Ted Nugent collector myself. Can you make a website like that for me? Yeah, I could do that. No problem. He goes, all right, cool. One of these days, and he started sending me all these pictures of his collection, and his collection was ridiculous. He had like Ted Nugent's leather boots and his leather jacket from when he was in the Amboy Dukes, and he had Ted Nugent's guitar. I mean, crazy, ridiculous stuff. Anyhow, so we stay in touch with this guy, me and him. We become friends online, you know, talk on the phone and whatnot. Come to find out he's a very wealthy businessman, and what he does is he does – I'm not exactly how you explain it, but like, you know, you see all the hotels that have water parks like inside of them.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Okay. So he goes to the whatever city is putting one of those in to make sure it's a viable thing and it's actually going to be, you know, successful and it's a good place to put it. And so he goes, that's what he was doing. So he was very, very well off, lived out in this beautiful home in the middle of farmland in the middle of nowhere, but this beautiful home. And he also had a, as part of this, he had a rescue farm for greyhounds that were,
right.
When they were done racing anymore, yeah, he would take them on rather than allowing them to be put down.
Okay.
So anyhow, I became friends with him over the years, and one day he calls me up, and he knew I was a Christian, and he wasn't. But he called me up one day, bawling on the phone. I'm like, "What's up, man? What's wrong?" He's like, "My sister just had a stroke. She's in the hospital. They don't know if she's going to make it." He goes, "Will you please pray for my sister?" I said, "Absolutely, I'll pray for your sister." I said, "Let's pray for her right now." So I prayed with him on the phone for her, and I said, "I'm going to give you a call. I'm going to pray every day for her, but I'm going to let you know if I'm going to pray every day, I'm going to be calling you to find out how she's doing." Mm-hmm. He goes, "That's cool, man. I appreciate it." So every 2 to 3 weeks, I just call, and he was a busy guy. So sometimes I'd talk to him. Sometimes I'd leave a message for him. "Hey, man, this is Scott. What's up? Just calling to see how you're doing, how your sister's doing. Hope all's, you know, well." A couple months go by, and he's like, "She's actually out of the hospital. She's going to live." A few months more go by. She's getting back her ability to walk and talk. She may even be able to drive again. You know, he's just kept praying. And eventually she was able to drive again. So it was just, you know, after a year of this, he's like, "Dude, I want to give you something for," he goes, "you don't know how much I appreciate you praying and calling and checking up on me for this whole year." He goes, "So I want to give you something." I'm like, "No, man, that's not what it's about." He's like, "You have to take my gift." He's like, "You can't turn down my gift." So I'm like, "All right, I don't want to be a jerk either, you know." I had no idea what it was. For all I knew, it just could have been a record. Nope. It was plane tickets to fly out to his home and a big plane to fly out to the major city, and then another small charter plane to fly out to close to where he lived. Because like I said, he lived in the middle of nowhere in cornfields. And he picked me up at the airport, takes me to his home. And he bought us not only tickets to go see Nugent in another state, but he went and got a hold of the Nugent organization, made a huge donation for Ted Nugent's Camp for Kids. And wow. Got us not just backstage passes. We spent the entire day with Ted Nugent.
That's cool.
Ted flew in that morning. We met him at the airport. We stayed with him all day long. We watched the show from half the show from the side of the stage and the other half from the pit in the front of the stage, the security pit.
Yeah.
So it was a blast.
That's amazing.
And Nugent was so nice. Sat and ate shrimp gumbo with him. My buddy brought, I'm not even kidding when I say my buddy brought about 1,000 things for him to sign. Not an exaggeration. Ridiculous. He spent an hour and a half just signing crap. But wow. Nugent was loving it because he had like the Japanese import version of the first Amboy Dukes when Nugent was like 15 years old on the cover. And so he was like just, you know, big smiles, telling us stories about the band and talking about politics and all this. And just total gentleman. He wasn't like the hyper guy you see online. You know, he's just total nice guy, total gentleman. Anyhow, long story short, on the ride home, he goes, from the Nugent show, he goes, "I want to tell you why I did all this for you." He goes, "It's not just because you're praying for my sister." He goes, I've been suicidal for the last year. And he goes, "And there was a bunch of days where I was sitting on the floor with a gun to my head. And for some reason I would check the stupid answering machine as I'm sitting there contemplating suicide." He goes, "Every single time I was doing it," he goes, there you were. Hey, man, it's Scott. Just calling to see how you're doing. And
wow.
Every time. I'm like, wow, that was, I mean, I still get shivers thinking about it now. A couple years later, he did end up committing suicide. So it's not a happy ending, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I'm hoping I'll see him in heaven someday. I can't tell you. I did pray with him for salvation. That doesn't mean he actually, you know, received Jesus as a savior. I don't know. I found out about it. His he did go to church. He was going to a church, and his pastor called me and told me, you know, what had happened. Really, very, very sad story. It was in all the papers, so this is public information. But he was on painkillers. He had really bad spine issues, and he said the painkillers were making him go nuts. And he really thought the painkillers were making him feel suicidal. So he decided to get off the painkillers. But he didn't go through a doctor. He went cold turkey.
That's rough.
Yeah. So he snapped. Yeah. And this is really sick. So I'm sorry to say this, but he went outside and shot all the dogs in the farm. All the greyhounds, went inside. His wife was asleep in the bed, shot her in the head, laid down next to her and shot himself in the head.
Oh my gosh.
So it's an awful story. All I can say is I hope to see him in heaven someday. I just don't know. You tend to think of people like that as being a total monster, but that's not the guy I knew. You know, he wasn't a monster. All I can say is drugs are a bad deal.
No, yeah. I mean, I can speak from personal experience. You know what? Prescription medication, you mix it with something or do something. I mean, that stuff can make you have thoughts that you're normally not going to have.
Let me finish the story real quick just so I can, but hanging on the wall right over here, I know you can't see it, but after this all happened, Ted knew him obviously because of so my wife, I have a picture of me, his name is Morgan, me, Morgan and Ted Nugent together. So my wife took 2 8x10s and shipped them off to Ted and told Ted this, you know, what had happened. And I guess he had already knew. Well, Ted sent the photo back and signed it to me. He says, we are blood brothers. In the wind, he's still alive, Ted Nugent. And I got it signed up on my wall over there. So talk about meeting an artist and having it be very personal.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah,
that's awesome. And wrap it up here. Just a couple more things. So I did want to mention, of course, your YouTube channel. And if you wanted to kind of talk about what you do on there and where people, I know you mentioned earlier, you know, people check it out. But you do go over a lot of, you go over Christian stuff, you go over non-Christian, I call it album reviews and stuff. And I really enjoy why I like watching the one, you know, you talk about like Holy Soldier and or Tourniquet or whatever it might be, but I enjoy when you do that kind of stuff too.
Yeah, I do. So my YouTube channel is No Left to Metal. You can just look under Scott Waters if you're looking for me, or No Left to Metal, all one word, NOLIFTILMETAL. But yeah, I do basically a bunch of different segments. I do album updates where I show stuff that I added to my collection. I do box set videos where I show different box sets. I also do No Left to Metal graphics videos where I show all the different stuff that I've worked on and, you know, what was involved in that. And sometimes I'll explain it and what went wrong with it, what those kind of things, and what went right with it. You know, this album cover came out great. This came out too dark, but I can't be in front of a printing press and tell them to lighten it. So, you know, right. So those kind of videos. And then I also do a lot of I bring in guests like Randy Trog, and we do, you know, reviews of best albums of 1975, best albums of 1990, those kind of things. And we'll go through the top 30 albums of that year. So yeah, we do all kinds of fun stuff. And then I also have a channel called Four Words, The Metal Round Table, that I do every Tuesday with two other guys. And that one is a little different, where we bring in guests to like you do. And we've brought in everybody from, we've had Dark Angel and Saxon and all kinds of different death and black metal bands I don't even know, because they book everybody. I'm more into like traditional death metal and thrash and heavy metal and hard rock and that kind of thing. And some of the guys are more into the black metal and that kind of stuff. So we get into all that stuff on that channel.
I don't think I've watched that. I have to check it out.
It's interesting because it's a very interesting dynamic, because I'm really good friends with the three guys. We come from very different belief systems, but we get along great. We all like heavy metal. So it's a fun show.
Yeah. It sounds like, with everyone having a different perspective, that keeps it interesting. As
yeah,
if everyone had the same opinion, it probably wouldn't be very interesting to watch, I'm sure. But yeah. With any other projects or ultimatum? I mean, is anything else on the horizon coming up? People could ultimatum be looking forward.
Ultimatum has been on, we call it hiatus. We never really broke up or stopped. We put out the box set in 2012 with Rox. And then after that, it just, I basically got, I had some issues in my personal life that I had to deal with. My mother-in-law was dying and then someone needed to be their helper and just stuff like that got in the way. So we just kind of put it on hold and we just never have gotten back to it. Everybody's moved on in life and I'm not saying it won't ever happen, but we've got together, we get together once in a while, just talk. We've got together a few times and just jammed in somebody's garage. Rob Whitlock, the guy I told you about, he's a part owner of a brewery and restaurant here in Albuquerque. He was a plumber. Now he's the head brewer for that company. and he's an award-winning beer maker now. So, I mean, that is a lot of responsibility for him. So we're all just got different things going on and I got my own business. So yeah, I just don't see Ultimatum happening anytime soon.
Okay.
And the other thing is unless Ultimatum is going to be Christ-centered as it was when we were together, I don't want it to happen anyhow. And some of the guys in the band aren't at that point right now. And without a few of the guys in the band, it's not Ultimatum to me. So we just won't do it. It's gotta be Robert Gutierrez. It's gotta be Rob Whitlock and myself, those three guys. Without them, it's just not Ultimatum. So yeah, that's why it's not going to happen anytime soon. You never know what God's got in store. And like I said, we're all still friends. We still talk all the time, but whether or not that'll happen, I don't know. I mostly focus on the record stuff. Now I have so much fun working with all these different record labels. We just announced yesterday the Petra 3-disc box set.
I saw that. Yeah.
And I got to do all the work for that. That was a blast. I just finished up a box set for, Keith Green. And a box set for Scattered Few. I know you can't see because nobody's watching.
Yeah, for Spy Glass Blue.
I just finished a box set for Accuser, German thrash band. And I'm working on a few more box sets that I'm not allowed to talk about. But some more Christian stuff that you'll dig coming out soon. Just finished up an album for the Mainline Riders with Cliffy Huntington as the main guy. Very much in the style of like AC/DC, Rhino Bucket, Dirty Talk, Dirty Looks. So that's cool.
From the Huntingtons?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, I know nobody else can see, but Mainline, I don't know if you've heard this album, but it's coming out.
Mainline Riders?
Is their second album. It's so good. It's, like I said, very much AC/DC. It's got a punk edge too because it's Cliffy, but you'll definitely hear the AC/DC influence, the Rhino Bucket, the Dirty Look kind of stuff. It's very hard to find that album, but it's coming out soon on Retroactive Records. My own label just put out 4 albums this weekend.
What's the name of your label?
No Life to Metal Records.
Okay, it's under that too.
Which is a partnership of Rox Records. So I'm not really the owner of the label. Bill is the owner of the label, and he's using my name. So it's my business license, but his label. Okay. but yeah. So Rox is a Christian label. No Life Till Metal is, I'm not going to say it's not Christian, but it's bands who don't fit neatly into that Christian label. So a band like Galactic Cowboys would go on No Life Till Metal because
they're bands full of Christians.
Or in the case of like, we just released the Primal record. Fantastic album. If you're a fan of Early Deliverance, get the Primal record. It's Glenn Rogers.
Check that out.
Glenn Rogers is the main guy behind Primal. He wrote a bunch of the stuff on the first Deliverance record, so the style is very similar. And also the singer comes from the Argentina band called V8 and Logos, which are also a Christian band.
And that's a new release from those guys?
Just went on sale yesterday on the NoLifeTillMetalRecords.com site. So there's Avenger of Blood, which is a band that we opened for coming through town that I remain friends with to this day, now on our label. That's coming. Their new album is coming out. It's called Completely Reannihilated. The Primal record, which is called Hue Machine, that's available. A band called Reptilian, which is the guitar player from the ex-guitar player from Reverend, David Wayne's band.
Yeah. And I checked that out. That some people might get triggered listening to that album if they lean certain ways towards political.
That's why it's on No Life Till Metal and not on rocks.
Okay, that makes sense.
And then the drummer in that band was in Annihilator.
Okay.
And then we put out the last one, Absalon, which is their second album.
Yeah.
Queens, yeah, right?
I'm friends with Ken.
Ken, yeah.
I debuted that album for him. So if anybody's interested, I had him on for an episode where we went through and the full album's on there too. Also, go to your site. If they just go to rocksrecords.com too, you can connect.
Yeah, where you can go to my website, nolessmetal.com, right, and just click on the word records. It'll take you there. Or you can go to nolessmetalrecords.com and get there as well. So, yeah, that's what's going on. That's the new stuff.
Yeah, it sounds like you're pretty busy. And, I mean, that's really cool because you got a lot going on. You're a very talented person.
The new bride's coming out. So there's a new bride EP coming out called Open Your Eyes. And then the full-length album coming out later this year called Are You Awake?
Did you do the album work for the cover, or are you doing what have you done with that?
I did the layout and design for both albums. The cover artwork was by, name is skipping my mind, from Brazil, but the band had the cover made before they signed with Retroactive. So yeah, it was already done by the time I got involved in it.
Do you get the luxury of getting to hear these albums before they come out with stuff like that? So you've already heard the new Bride.
Yes.
Are you allowed to say anything? I mean, I'm not details, but
if you
thoughts.
Like the last one, it's very much straightforward heavy metal Bride. I mean, it's very much in the vein of, I think it's better than Snake Eyes, or at least as good as the last album. It's just what you want to hear from Bride. It's not that far off from, you know, the last couple albums.
Yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to that as
Bride. I mean, excuse the pun, but Dale is screaming like a demon on that album. So he's fantastic. He just sounds so good.
Yeah.
And the EP coming out first is going to be a very short run. It's going to have 6 songs on it. Two of those tracks will never show up on any other release again. So if you don't get the EP, you'll never get them any other way.
And who's putting both of those out? Is that Retroactive?
Retroactive Records. Yep.
What I always like is to let my guests have the last word. If there's anything you want to say to anybody listening or fans of the band or just people that follow you, you know, what would you like to put out there and say to them to close out?
I appreciate anybody who's listened to any Ultimatum and who, you know, is a fan of the band or the music. I very much appreciate it. I'm very much appreciative, especially of the people who buy all the music, not just Ultimatum, but any of the stuff coming out on Rocks and Retroactive and, you know, all the different labels I work for, because if it wasn't for you guys buying the physical media, I'd be out of a job. unfortunately, so would the bands, because they're not making any money on digital sales these days. They're not making any money at all on streaming. So without you buying those physical media, the labels wouldn't exist, nor would the bands. It just wouldn't happen. So definitely appreciative of all that. Even though we're not selling millions of records anymore, you know, we're only selling thousands of records. It's still, you know, people like to disrespect the record labels and like, I want the band to get all the money. Well, the labels put a lot of money into those bands and into those recordings and into the product. So it's only fair that the labels should make their money back as well. I don't know why people have such a negative stigma about record labels. You know, now that I'm in that business and see what's going on, I see how much time, money, and sacrifice going into putting out the new Bride, not just from the band, but the label. So, you know, both deserve to get paid for what they do. So, anyhow, I'm not sure how I got into that from thanking people, but there you go. It's my secret sin. It's
It's got no power of a